What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions, like who is actually stepping in to save people from sorcery accusation violence in Papua New Guinea?
So she was gasping for air inside the people in a group there, and then they accused her, like, you must be the sorceress.
To listen, search Politalk in your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review. On this show, we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up, polygamy is part of Papua New Guinea's culture, but is it being abused?
Sometimes we take our PNC way out of proportion. Maybe it's about time we look at polygamy in its fullest sense. What relevance is it saving our country today?
A new study has found that decaying World War II bombs are leaking toxic chemicals into the food chain in Solomon Islands.
Communities have reported symptoms after eating seafood from these locations, including rashes and vomiting, illness in infants through breastfeeding.
And calls for government action over a long-running seawater contamination event in Papua New Guinea. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. An Australian billionaire is at the center of a controversial plan to ship waste to Fiji, where it'll be used for generating electricity. But the waste-to-energy plan is facing fierce pushback from community members because the proposed location for this scheme is in the heartland of Fiji's tourism industry. The ABC's Fina Fonua filed this report as public consultations into the project begin.
This melody tells the story of the first Fijians, who according to tradition, sailed from Africa to the Pacific. The place of first landing is believed to be Vunda Point, on the west coast of the main island of Viti Levu. The area is known for its natural beauty, and the hidden gem is the scenic Sawini Beach. It's primed for tourism development, but it's also the proposed site of a $900,000 waste-to-energy facility.
Energy from waste is coming. We happen to be the first one bringing it. It will be built. This is Australia needs it, New South Wales needs it.
The investor behind the concept is Australian billionaire Ian Maloof, here being interviewed by 7 News in 2018 about a similar waste-to-energy facility that he wanted to build in New South Wales. It failed to get approval and was met with public backlash.
A lot of questions to be answered, but really, does New South Wales need a 1.3 million ton incinerator smack bang in Western Sydney? I don't think so.
Mr. Maloof now wants to build it in Fiji, investing in a company known as TNG Fiji. The plan is to create a facility where rubbish will be collected and turned into energy to supply Fiji's electricity grid. It's an ambitious project. However, not enough rubbish is available in Fiji to make it viable, so the plan is for most of the rubbish to be shipped in from Australia, Papua New Guinea, and other Pacific islands. A port is planned to be built off of Vunda. Those promoting it say it would reduce Fiji's dependence on petroleum imports and create over 1,000 jobs. Sounds good, but some people are worried, and among them is Amitesh Deo, Director of Waste Recyclers Fiji Limited.
Waste to energy definitely has a place as a solution model within the waste management space, but it's really important, and this is our position, that we realize that recycling and sustainability approaches has to be first.
He says health, environmental, and economic factors all need to be evaluated before any decision is made.
there is a huge risk that recyclables will end up there. In Fiji, we have a lot of people who are dependent on informal waste picking recyclables for their survival. So their survival, their livelihood could be impacted. But also, we need to clearly understand the impact of the plant on our environment, on health.
An environmental assessment on the proposed venture is currently underway, along with public consultations with the community and stakeholders. The first public consultation was heated, with Ian Maloof facing questions from an irritated audience.
I think there was a lot of, in the sense of, one could say, disrespect that was shown to the landowning communities and others who were present there, because it did not resonate very closely to a consultation, but more about what was planned to be done.
They almost had a free-for-all brawl.
Ronald Blake was one resident who attended the consultations. He says even if the proposed venture was to pass the environmental assessment, the pristine area should be used for tourism. He's also concerned the port would offer another point of entry into Fiji for drug traffickers.
The backbone of our economy is tourism, and they're wanting to put this incinerator down by the belt of Fiji's tourism industry. As you're aware, we're facing a bit of a drug issue in Fiji. Now, when you're bringing in packaged rubbish, border control's basically got to open the package and check everything.
So why not build the facility somewhere else? Why Vunda Point? The deep waters around the area, along with a secure inland basin, offer an ideal location for a port. According to Lee Ann Forrest, an expat deeply opposed to the idea, the location is zoned as a tourism area, and there's already interest from investors who want to build resorts in the area.
The area on their maps where they have located the proposed plant is not at Vunda Point. It is at Nakorokoro Point, and it is not zoned industrial. So there's this, it's quite misleading, and that has been pointed out to them at each of the three consultation meetings, and it's been asked of them, why do they persist on calling it Vunda Point when it isn't Vunda Point? They persist on calling it Vunda Point and saying that it's already zoned industrial, which it isn't. They would have to have that rezoning permission to allow it to happen.
Perhaps the most prominent of those to oppose the plan is the Tui Vunda, the paramount chief of Vunda district. Initially backing the proposal, the Tui Vunda released a statement denouncing the plans.
The Vunda district will not entertain or endorse any further engagement with the waste-to-energy factory project. The chief's directive represents a decisive stance, rejecting developments that threaten our environment and heritage while embracing those that bring dignity, opportunity and international recognition to Vunda.
Spokesperson for the Lady Chief of Lawaki Village, Josateki Kelly, attended the public consultations where he voiced the Lady Chief's opposition.
There was a question which I actually voiced over to Ian Maloof, and I asked him, are you aware that the Vunda Sawini coastal corridors is actually zoned by the Town Country Planning of Fiji as the first class tourism for tourism first class development? And he was actually not answering the question. That question was never answered.
Mr. Kelly said that an investor was already interested in building a large resort in the area, and that tourism was favored as a more sustainable means of income for the district.
This is what Fiji is looking for, like investment of this type, which bring in benefits to the local community and also uplift the national economy of the country, since Fiji is relying on tourism. And this is what Fiji is actually looking for.
The results of the environmental impact assessment could be the decision maker about whether the project should be implemented. The future of Vunda District, the area where the first Fijians arrived, remains in the air.
Finau Funua with that report, and the ABC has sought comment from Australian businessman Ian Maloof and the Fiji government as well. In Papua New Guinea, polygamy has deep roots in traditional culture. It's practiced for generations across parts of the country. But the Prime Minister, James Marape, says the tradition is being twisted and is now fueling family breakdown and violence. As Belinda Cora in PNG reports, the Prime Minister wants reforms, even changes to the constitution. But critics say you can't legislate culture, and banning polygamy won't solve the problem of violence against women.
A person that has more than one or two or three or four wives is not able to manage his family base well. And the person goes to a society that today many kids unmanaged, running around, doing almost nothing but havoc to our society.
PNG's Prime Minister says the traditional practice of a man having multiple wives is undermining women's safety. Mr. Marape says a legal reform is needed to address the problem, and a solution could mean constitutional changes.
Sometimes we take our PNG way out of proportion. Maybe it's about time we look at polygamy in its fullest sense. What relevance is it saving our country today?
But one political expert believes the Prime Minister is taking the wrong approach in dealing with polygamy.
You can't legislate human behavior like marrying more than one wife. Legislation is usually not the answer to cultural issues. Usually it is education.
Dr. Joe Ketan is a Papua New Guinean academic, political scientist and social researcher known for his expertise in electoral politics and tribal dynamics. He says behavioral changes occur over time. He says polygamy is a custom in the Central Highlands region and was a norm accepted by many until the arrival of missionaries. And those big men include parliamentarians and leaders across PNG, including within the Prime Minister's own cabinet. One of the four MPs that I reached out to has supported a call by Mr. Marape. He believes the traditional value of polygamy is no longer in existence. Sasindren Mutuvel is the governor for West New Britain province.
While you me respecting culture blow you me, tradition blow you me, where polygamy am once am serving purpose blow.
While we respect our culture and traditions, where polygamy once served the purpose of building clan alliances, protection of widows, or when we try to expand our family size, or even in large-scale agriculture farming, at that time, it was applicable. But today, in a more modern cash-driven PNG, it's very different. Now polygamy contributes to family breakdowns, jealousy, neglect, and violence, and information from a demographic and health survey shows clearly that close to 19 to 20%, or 1 in 5 married women in PNG.
Patricia Mamele is a human rights defender and works with women in the capital, Port Moresby. She's seen the impact of polygamy on communities.
Comes to family, it actually really breaks families. And then it escalates to like children being on the street, children being exposed to other things surrounding violence, which hasn't been addressed fully.
She says most families in the capital are affected by polygamy. However, banning it isn't the answer to ending violence against women.
Have we really gone out to all the provinces, to all the communities? In NCD, have we walked the street? Have we spoken about it? A lot of decisions are made in Parliament, and there's not a lot of awareness about it in the communities. Walk the streets and talk about it. Those politicians sitting there, go to your communities and talk to the people that, you know, we're going to do this in Parliament. Do you want it?
As for political expert Dr. Ketan, he wants deeper research into the practice of polygamy and how it has evolved so there can be a better understanding of its place in society and its purpose.
And that was the ABC's reporter in PNG, Belinda Cora, reporting on Prime Minister James Marape's moves to put reforms into place to make polygamy illegal. Landmines, munitions and unexploded ordnances left over from the Second World War pose major safety risks to communities in the Pacific. But now, new research has proven that they don't need to explode to threaten lives. A study from the University of Queensland and the United Nations Development Programme has found that thousands of decaying bombs in Solomon Islands are releasing toxic chemicals onto the land and sea, threatening the health of locals in coastal areas. Raluca Eden is UNDP's deputy resident representative in the country and say the chemicals are making locals sick.
We are finding that they are contaminating the land areas and also affecting marine lives, marine ecosystems. Explosive residue, for example, in shellfish that we collected from coastal areas shows that contamination is moving through the food chains. And communities have reported symptoms after eating seafood from these locations, including rashes and vomiting, illness in infants through breastfeeding. And while more research certainly is needed, the exposure pathways are quite clear.
How has that impacted the health of local people?
They feel sick after eating clams or fish, for example, from certain areas. So they generally avoid those places. They also told us that they cannot farm in certain areas because of the heavy contamination. And they also shared their fears, especially mothers, especially for children living and playing near such threats.
Now, I understand that you yourself live in the Solomon Islands. I know you've spoken to a lot of the communities that live close to these UXOs. What kind of stories have you heard from them in your time in the Solomon Islands?
We see that, in fact, UXO impacts the many facets of people's lives. And that's why we also think that this is more than just an environmental story or just a story about security. It is a story, it's a development story fundamentally, because it affects food, health, and livelihoods.
Guadalcanal was such a huge battle at the time. Like, how much ordnance remains in the country? Like, can you measure it, or is it just impossible to measure?
The focus mainly until now has been on the immediate danger of explosions, which have saved many lives. What is new now is that the science is showing the long-term environmental contamination. So we estimate that about 65% of the remaining ordinances on Guadalcanal. We also know that a lot of it is very close to the coastline, so within 1 kilometer, or most of it within 5 kilometers of the coastline. So this is an accelerating crisis, an accelerating problem that is worsened by climate change, because, of course, with increasing floods or extreme weather events, more of the UXO gets exposed, and therefore the risk of contamination increases.
And that was the UNDP Solomon Islands Deputy Resident Representative, Raluca Eden, speaking there with the ABC's Kyle Evans. You're listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka, taking a look at some of the big stories from across the Pacific throughout the week. A 7.6 magnitude earthquake sparked fear and panic in Tonga when it struck earlier in the week. The quake struck near the island of Vava'u and occurred at a depth of more than 200 kilometres. Despite its depth, it could be felt hundreds of kilometres away, and it triggered tsunami sirens across the kingdom. Marion Lehape lives on the island of Vava'u, and she says the quake was so strong it sent her running out of her house, only to witness it being moved up and down in the tremor.
It was very strong. And I was in the house with the family, so it's just me and my 2 kids and my husband. And we were shocked when it was started to shake. And I thought it's going to be end, but, you know, it took long to end to shaking. But we felt it was very strong. Yeah, and my 2 kids, you know, I think this is the first time for them to experience this.
I can hear the sirens in the background, so it's still going.
Because we are at the main town now, but we cannot hear it from where I stay. But we are at the main town, at a store in the main town.
You've evacuated to a safe place?
No, where we live, if so.
Can you describe the reaction from people around you? Do you see people evacuating or kind of ilifia, panicking?
I don't really see people evacuating on our way here. Our neighbors too, I don't see any evacuating to other places. We just stayed in our own house.
When the earthquake happened, did anything fall? How strong was it? Could you describe?
The house was moving, and that's why we ran outside, and we see the house is shaking when we stood outside. But only one neighbor came outside. you know, the mother and the daughter, they came outside and we talked outside, seeing the house was moving.
How many times have you experienced earthquakes like this?
I think this is the first time to experience a very strong earthquake, and it was long. This is my first time to experience this in Lalao. We had earthquake before, but it's not very strong like this one. You know, on our way to the shop, I did not see any like people on the way to evacuate to other places.
Why do you think that is? Why is that?
I just thought because I think that people, you know, they feel safe at where they are now. But I don't know about people who are living close to the ocean. I think they are the only people who try to evacuate to other places, you know, to a higher places.
And that was Vava'u resident Marion Lehape, and she was speaking there to the ABC's Finau Funua. Seawater contamination off the coast of Papua New Guinea's New Island province is being described as not just an environmental crisis, but a social one too. For the past 4 months, local communities have reported dead fish washing ashore and a spike in illness linked to contact with the water. The provincial government is trying to identify the source of the contamination. But anthropologist Professor Paige West from Columbia University in New York, who spent decades working in New Island, says officials should have acted much sooner.
The causes remain unconfirmed, and so samples of the water and I believe the fish tissues have been sent out to laboratories to do testing to see what's causing it. What's happening in New Island is devastating. But for me, these are not the kind of abstract communities that we hear some international activists talking about. But these are places and people that I have longstanding relationships with. It's not simply an environmental event. It's a social crisis. And, you know, what I'm thinking most around this is we're seeing once again an international community that seems most capable of paying attention only when damage like this becomes dramatic. It's dramatic enough to command international notice. But communities like the ones that are being affected by this in New Ireland have been living with this kind of long, slow, uneven violence that's produced by climate change and other forms of ecological degradation that are actually generated elsewhere but born there. And so I think this crisis, whether it has a kind of easily recognizable biological cause like an algae bloom or a less easily recognizable cause like an algae event combined with runoff from a plantation, this is something that is certainly connected to humans. And it's certainly connected to humans who are consuming in a different part of the world, not the people being directly affected by it in New Ireland.
So communities have been saying they've been waiting for months for water test results. Why do you think there's such a delay?
I don't know. I do know that the samples were sent to two different labs, and I just don't know what's happening. I just don't know what's happening with those labs. Because I've never worked in biological sample testing before, I don't have any idea how long it takes.
So when communities are forced to stop fishing due to contamination, what are the deeper social and cultural impacts beyond just income?
Well, so it's not just income. These are communities. I believe the number is that over 75% of people living in New Ireland depend on fishing for their livelihood, both for fishing for markets where they might sell the fish, but also for their local sustenance. And so we're talking about creating conditions where people have to go elsewhere to find food for themselves and their families. So that's one kind of social transformation. But also, these are folks that have a really deep spiritual relationship with the sea. And they also have a very deep knowledge of the sea. And these changes that we're seeing are unsettling to people. And the kind of uncertainty is both about the food source that they no longer have access to, but also about the future of their communities, because if you think about these folks, how do you live in a place where your ancestors have always lived, where the sea has been the source of your sustenance and the source of your kind of social history when the sea is no longer safe?
So how dangerous is it for communities to live with uncertainty, not knowing whether their water is safe or not?
The unsettling nature of this is that people don't know when it's going to end. They don't know where it's going to happen again. They don't know if there's going to be a larger event where all of the fish are unsafe to eat. And this is causing a kind of deep internal turmoil for people.
And that was Paige West, professor of anthropology at Columbia University in New York. And she was speaking there to the ABC's Leah Lowanbu. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific region.